Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on the history of a family carried on in a child. Don't let the lyricism of the name Callie Violet obscure the intent and the weight of those words. Camille Dungy's daughter is so named for the continuity her mother wanted. Persistence personified, she confides in her new book. Motherhood has deepened Miss Dungy's appreciation for family legacy, her acute awareness of what it means to raise a child of color in America, and her attention to the natural world. We'll talk about all of that as Camille Dungy joins me, but I think it'd be interesting to hear from you, too. Is there a part of your family history that defines your family somehow? And maybe it's a part of the family history that's even painful, but you've made sure that your kids understand it. These are stories that you've felt compelled to pass on and tell. Think about that. Join the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. At Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Camille Dungy is a professor of creative writing at Colorado State University. Her new book is titled Guidebook to Relative Strangers, Journeys into Race, Motherhood, and History. And she's with us from Fort Collins, Colorado. Camille, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
I want to return to that idea of the continuity and the persistence that your daughter carries in her name. Callie is a family name, right?
It is.
Tell me about it.
It was my grandmother's first name, and it was her grandmother's first name also. So when I found out I was pregnant, I thought if it was a girl, it seemed an obvious choice.
Is it a name that carries more than just, hey, there are grandparents who had this name for you, more significance? Sounds like it does.
I don't know the answer to that question. It's such an interesting question. Violet, the Violet part definitely is. It was my husband's grandmother's name also. And so the sense of being able to hold generations together in one new life is very important to me. The continuity of possibilities that we have each time we bring a new life into the world, that was important to give to my child.
You know, when I thought about the history of your daughter's name and the significance of it in your family, I thought, in some ways, it's an unusual thing these days to reach back into a family and come up with, you know, maybe something that sounds a little old-fashioned or has historical significance. I wonder if we've gotten out of the habit of doing
that. I don't
that.
Believe we have, actually. There's a number of Violets in my daughter's peer cohort,
really?
Many of whom are named after grandchildren. I think there's often a regeneration of names that comes across decades and generations. And so names go and come in and out of favor. I think that this is equally important to me, this idea that things that are recycled, are cherished, that we don't actually need to let everything go entirely, that our history is important to us as part of who we are. And I think naming is one of the ways to assert that.
I have to say, you've really surprised me that there are that many Violets popping up in.
It surprised us, too, I have to say. But it seems to be a relatively popular name. And I ask people often the names that they selected for their children. And very frequently that they will tell me that it's something their grandparents or a parent who they lost and loved very much. And so I think this idea of holding on to who we love through naming is something that's pretty common in a way that I like to be a part of that community.
Okay. You know what? You've inspired me to add this to ask our listeners this morning to think about it. So I'm asking about family stories and carrying that on within the family. But I also want to know from any of you if there is a name that has come down through the generations, and maybe you carry it, Maybe you've named your son or daughter this name and the significance of that, too. So let's add that to the mix. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Hey, you can tweet the name at me on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. And Jonathan says here, Camille, I've been interviewing my grandparents and then using those interviews to create a podcast for my kids. Talk to me about what you say to your daughter about her grandparents and the family history. I mean, how do you tell those stories to her?
It's so wonderful. When she was a baby and I was still in the point of singing her lullabies, I actually had a lullaby that I had created that went through all the women's names from the first woman who we can name in our family line all the way through my mother and then me, and connecting her through that list of sung names. And so the sense of singing, of podcasting, of writing these stories she was an infant, so obviously that didn't go into her conscious memory, but I certainly hoped it became part of what enveloped her in her development.
A call here from Taryn in Mora, Minnesota. Hi, Taryn.
Hi. You were talking about some unpleasant history that needs to be talked about.
Yeah.
And, both sides of my family comes from a long line of addictive behavior, a lot of alcoholism in the past, and then some cocaine in the, more present. And always in my own life, I really kept my eye on that. And I remember having a talk with my son as he was in, his mid to late teens, and just explained the, how that can be kind of inherited, that mm-hmm. proneness, I guess. And we had a big talk about it, and I said, I know you probably tried drinking. You might try some drugs. But no, that you're at a, a higher danger level, that one of these things will get a hold of you. And I thought that was a really important conversation, and he heeded it, as far as I know. He's in his mid-30s now, and no problem, rarely drinks. I don't know if he smokes a little pot, he's fine. And I think, that conversation made me feel better, and I assume it, made him think.
Taryn, this is a really great example that I hadn't really considered, because this is sharing a family history to be protective of a child. And some of the things that you obviously had to tell your son about his grandparents and other relatives is not especially flattering, but you did it for the best reasons, the most necessary reasons.
I mean, it was just a fact, and I guess in a way it's not a shame issue or anything like that. It's just, you need to know this, about your genes, and, keep your eye on it. I did, and never had any problem. And maybe I had a gene for that. Maybe I didn't. But like I said, it was important to me, and it was very important, for my son to know that.
Good to have the call. Thanks, Taryn. To Eric in Rochester. Hi, Eric. How does this fit in your family?
Well, I was just going to say that my wife, both of our children are named after members of previous generations in our family.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife's family, my son is actually named after three different members of her family. My father-in-law's name is Jan, which is John in Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
Her grandfather was from Germany, and his name was Johannes. And then my father-in-law's dad is also named John. So we named our son Jonathan, and he's kind of...
So it's meant to be.
Yes, absolutely.
Does he know all the stories about, what the meaning of his name is?
Yeah, he does.
Oh, good to have the call. Camille, I was also, when I read those chapters where you go through all these endearments that you call Callie, I mean, they reach back into your family history and they reach back into African history. And then this is where you say there is no escaping history. So would you explain how the endearments fit into that? This is really lovely.
Well, I just have this whole list of names that I call her. And as you say, many of them, one of the names I call her quite frequently is Abina, which is a West African day name that speaks to the day of the week when she was born. And I feel like placing her in a number of ways there based on the day of the week she was born, and also by a connection to a people who very well may have been our people. And another nickname I give her is a Louisiana endearment, and that connects to many of my family line. And so these ways of, again, sort of placing her in the world, and I say in the book that when I use those names, she turns to it because of my tone and the lovingness in that tone. And so no matter what name she gets called out of my voice, it is a sense of welcome and love and support that I want her to get. And I think that's a pretty crucial thing to give any child, but I think it's definitely crucial to give a little Black girl in America.
Did you ever consider naming her Camille?
I never considered naming her to Camille.
Why?
But I have to say that Callie ends up being pretty close. We actually only have one letter different between our names. And so I didn't actually intend as much overlap as I had. My husband, you ask why. My husband is named after many generations in his family. And there's something really wonderful about having that direct continuity. But I had a feeling that this person, my child, was going to become such an individual that I wanted to also give her some individual space.
So this is interesting that you would describe it just like that, because I've been reading Sherman Alexie's memoir and ahead of a Talking Volumes event that we're having. And he has a whole chapter about what it means to be named for his father. So everybody, many of his friends, they still do, and his family members call him Junior. And he really feels ambivalent about that, because he says that Junior, with all of its family history, as complicated as that is, which is what the memoir is about, but it also kind of feels like it lacks a certain gravitas and dignity for the man that he is now. You know, it almost sounds like your husband is your husband a Junior?
He is not a Junior because the name that he goes by, which is his father's name, is not the name that he was called when he was a child. And he had to do some pretty direct separation to make sure that he became his own person. I should also add, as I think I write about in the book, the name that is my grandmother's name was not the name my grandmother used for herself. And so there might be something in my family about sort of naming, but also allowing space for the new person to have their own space. So you kind of carry the marker of the past, but you also move forward into your own kind of space and future.
That's really nice, because that's exactly, I think, what you encounter as an adolescent, right? You don't, if anything, you want to be anything but a carbon copy of a parent. And, you know, you reckon with that later on in your life. You want that space to be an individual. And having
the purpose of adolescence is to fledge, is to fly out on your own. And so, yes.
Exactly. Andrea says, my daughter, Adelina, is named after one of the first of my husband's Italian relatives in America. We found it on a family tree. That's cool. And to the phones to Janine in Fargo. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, my story is of a name that came down from my great-grandmother with each generation to my daughter. My great-grandmother, whose middle name was Isabel, lived on a farm in Kansas. And when she had my grandmother in 1884, she made the determination that her daughter was going to go to college. So she saved all of her egg money and sent her to college. And since then, I think really every female in my family has gone to college.
Wow.
But that name has come down with the story. I have my great-grandmother's gold watch to give to my daughter someday. And it's just been a story that's always been very inspirational to me about how important education is.
Janine, I am so happy you called, because higher education is a real legacy in Camille's family. And Camille, I wanted to talk about this. So your parents' grandparents, am I right? Your parents' grandparents were getting advanced degrees in an era when that was rare.
I'm a fourth-generation college professor in an African-American family.
Jeez.
So, yes, that's pretty rare.
Yeah. Well, what's the story about how these men and women were getting these advanced degrees in a time when few Americans were getting them, especially Americans of color?
Mm-hmm. It was a priority for my family on both sides. My grandmother was one of 12 children. She was born in 1917. She was one of the middle children. Every one of those 12 children was sent to college, university. Most of them went on for a higher degree after college as well. So this was one of these things that just... wasn't a question. You might leave home, go very far away. I actually had an uncle who went to Colorado State University out of Louisiana. He moved to Fort Collins, Colorado, and stayed here to get his master's degree because at that time, schools in the South would not allow most African Americans to go to college in the Southern state, but they would sometimes find ways to move to the West or the Midwest or the North to get those educations. And so by the time it got to me, there's no question whether or not you go to college, right, and go on to graduate school. That's just not even an option to not.
Well, you know, it made me wonder what happens if Callie Violet doesn't see higher education as her path and she decides, let's say college can't teach her as much about the world or the art that she wants to pursue. Is that okay?
I will say that I am actually very much in favor of gap years between high school and college. I think that many young people need space to explore and find themselves, and we don't encourage directed gap years enough. But both of her parents are college professors, and I think that we just, it's important to experience the kinds of connections that you make in college, both personal and intellectual. And I can't imagine that a child raised in our home would make that decision. So we'll cross that bridge when we come there. But
oh,
I just
gosh.
Have trouble fathoming that.
So that would be a no. It is not okay if Callie Violet decides not to go to college. Okay, just so we're clear on that.
I also think that there's all different kinds of higher education. So a liberal arts college is good for many people. A school that focuses on science and math might be good for another. I actually am not necessarily against a kind of trade school that would focus her energies into, I teach creative writing, so into arts, into fashion design, into something like that. But that is still something that's about focusing your attention. I'm a writer. I took the time to go to graduate school to apprentice myself to the craft, to really figure out how to do what I want to do the best way that I possibly can. And why wouldn't I encourage my daughter to be able to figure out a way to do that herself?
Beldonna says on Twitter, my great aunt's name was Belladonna. My grandpa named his daughter Beldonna, and my mom named me Beldonna, and my sister named her daughter Beldonna. Wow, what happens with the family reunions in that household? Betsy says, my middle daughter is Vivian Melinda, named for my grandma and my husband's stepmother's sister, who died young. Boy, Camille, we've really opened up a can of worms here with people. Let me grab a call from Adelia in Duluth. Hi, Adelia. Am I pronouncing your name right?
You are.
Adelia. What's the story?
I was just going to add that my husband's great-grandmother, who passed away just a few years ago in her late 90s, her name was Grace. And from her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and possibly even a few great-greats, there's about roughly 20 that have either her first her Grace name for their first or middle name.
Jeez. Wow. So how many Graces is, you said 20.
Just below or possibly just above at last count. We were talking about it over the summer at a family reunion, and I have my oldest daughter is Delilah Grace. My husband's grandmother is Donna Grace. His great grandmother was Grace. And there's three just in our little branch of the tree, you know. So there's a lot. And she had five children, and, you know, her name has definitely had a legacy of its own.
And how does that feel for your family, Adelia?
Well, it's really important to us. All of our children have family names. We have five children, me and my husband, and all of them have family names, both first and middle for the most part. There's a few names that are not necessarily family, but the middle name always is, at least. Like my husband is the second, which you were discussing a little while ago about like the junior aspect.
Yeah,
and my husband has the exact same name as his father, like first, middle, last. And so he's the second. And there's a lot of issues with that financially and stuff with having the exact same name as somebody.
Uh-huh.
And so when our oldest son was born, rather than naming him after my husband, he was named after my husband's grandfather. And so he's the second from my husband's grandfather rather than the third from my husband.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's quite, what about your name, Adelia? That's unusual too. Where's that come from? That's a family?
My name is Adelia Marie, and I was named after I believe it was like a great grandma on my father's side, and her name was Mary Adelia.
It's beautiful. Thanks.
Thank you
very much for calling. And Benny says, this is right to your point, Camille. Violet was the 47th most popular baby name in 2016. You were right off the start. I have another Callie here, and then I'm going to talk to you about some other things, but I have Suzanne in Hugo. Suzanne, what's the significance of Callie in your family?
Callie was my great aunt, my grandmother's sister, and my sister named her baby Callie Pearl.
Oh,
and Pearl
lovely.
Is my mother's name, and my mom now has one granddaughter and two great-granddaughters with the middle name of Pearl.
Wow.
So, but I love the name Callie.
I do, too. I don't know why. It feels old-fashioned to me. Camille, why is that, do you think?
I can tell you that in my legacy, I know that it was actually very popular in the 1870s, 1880s. And so it was very popular for like the first generation of free African American women.
Yeah.
You can go back to many actually African American female activists. There are a couple pretty major ones who were named Callie. So I liked that connection too, to a kind of a politically active, conscious woman from many centuries by the name of Callie, right?
Boy, that is how old is Callie Violet? She's got a lot to grow
she's
into.
She's only seven. She's got some she's got some space to
wow
make her place.
Okay, one more here, because Cora says, my name Cora was also that of a great-great-grandmother's. I never met her and don't encounter many others with the same name. And Cora, I have to tell you this, that our senior producer here for the show, he's the assistant program director. His daughter is named Cora, and I'd never heard of that until he named her Cora. So nice to know there's other Coras out there. Camille Dungy is with us this morning, if you've just tuned in, and we're talking about her book and some of the themes and ideas that she develops in it, Guidebook to Relative Strangers, Journeys into Race, Motherhood, and History. We started out talking about the legacy of a family name or a family story, and I'm hearing from a lot of you about what those names that come down through families mean. But Camille, one of the other things that your family's history and the history of your ancestors is intertwined with is the way you see the natural world. And until you mentioned that, was it your grandfather or great-grandfather who spent time in Colorado? I didn't realize that you had deep roots in the Fort Collins area in Colorado.
I don't know that I would necessarily call that great, he would have been a great-great-uncle's connection, okay, part of my deep roots. It's one of those ways in which, you know, the title Guidebook to Relative Strangers is much about, as I travel through the world, I go places where I think, why would I have any connection here? And then all of a sudden, through research or conversation, I discover ways in which I am connected, right? And ways in which we are all connected. And that's been part of the wonderful thing about journeying through the country in the way that I do, is finding all these places that might seem not hospitable to me that then actually have a place that I can claim as my own.
So, yeah, I'm thinking about the chapter Writing Home, and I asked if you would read a couple of paragraphs from that chapter. Is that okay?
Certainly.
Okay, good.
It is years later, and I am a traveler walking. I am on public land, a park, a knoll, a meadow. I am glad to own the memories I own, and through those memories to belong someplace, to have some place belong to me. I am remembering, and I am writing a poem in my many tongues, a poem having to do with comfort, something having to do with peace. Then a dog comes growling toward me. A dog with still tail and pointed ears. A dog with fanged mouth and purposeful eyes. The sky is quiet, and the dog is barking, and someone the dog trusts and will obey says, "Sicker, sick." If memory is home, I am a long way from hope. I have escaped and am running. I have to remember what has been said. I am black and female. No place is for my pleasure. How do I write about the land and my place in it without these memories? The runaway with the hounds at her heels. The complaint of the poplar at the man cry of its load. The land a thing to work, but not to own. How do I write about the land and my place in it without remembering, without shaping my words around the history I belong to, the history that belongs to me? The dog drags me to fields of memory where I toil from can see to can't. What I write about the land and my place in it is informed by this fact. Sometimes the landscape is of little comfort. Sometimes I want to run far away from home.
It's Camille Dungy reading from a chapter that I love in her new book. The chapter is called Writing Home, and the book is called Guidebook to Relative Strangers, Journeys into Race, Motherhood, and History. Because you write at length and breadth about the natural world, I wanted to share something of a conversation that I had with Helen MacDonald, who wrote the memoir Ages for Hawk. Did you have a chance to read it?
Yes, beautiful book.
So when she was here the second time, we started talking about how nature writing itself seems to have fallen out of favor, and her argument that it is so needed right now. And I thought I'd play just a little bit of that conversation for you and see what you think of this. Let's listen.
It's learning how to see the world differently that is what nature can give us. And I think we're all trapped in this world where we want to be surrounded by things that we think are like us. And I think nature teaches you to love difference. You know, if you look at a spider on your windowsill and try and imagine what it might be like to be a spider and to see through eight eyes and feel through your legs, you know, and I mean, just trying to expand your idea of what's possible and what the world is through doing that is a really intense experience.
Do you feel like nature writing has fallen out of favor in some ways, and that it is so necessary for the reasons Helen MacDonald just articulated?
I absolutely believe it is necessary for those reasons. I think that the necessity of understanding and embracing a diverse ecosystem, a world that is full of living beings that just are full of variety and possibility is crucial to our survival on this planet and our ability to help the rest of the living matter that we know now to survive. That's absolutely necessary. I'm not sure I agree that nature writing has fallen out of favor. I believe that there are a lot of people who really understand the necessity of understanding the world and who we are and how we fit. And so I write so frequently out of spaces of anxiety and devastation and danger. And if I didn't find ways to have hope, I would be in deep trouble. And looking out into the resiliency of the non-human world is often one of the places where I can find that kind of hope.
I really liked your chapter on hiking, even though you've run into a little bit of trouble. I'm a devoted hiker. I love it. It's the thing I'd rather do than anything else except reading. And you say, a good hike is an exercise in mindfulness, not just racing up and down a hill, but attending to each object passed along the way. Now, that's the challenge for me. You know, noticing, attending to it, hearing the sound, putting away the music on a hike.
It's part of the challenge of being a human moving through the world at this particular moment in our history. We don't slow down often. We don't look often. We don't think as empathetically and slowly as I think we might. I think living in the world as a writer and living in the world as a woman and an African-American woman at that, all of these parts of my experience heighten the need for me to be cautious and attentive, and I can decide to focus that heightened caution and attention in a way that's anxiety provoking, or I can focus it in a way that brings me as much pleasure as possible. And so that is what I try to do.
So even after you had your mishap, was it an ankle or a leg?
It was my ankle.
Your ankle. You broke it.
I broke it. Clear through.
Whoa. So even after that happened, you still, you're able to kind of push away the anxiety and be fully immersed and
I don't hike in sneakers anymore. Right? I'm sort of very cautious. That was just sort of a frivolous hike, and I didn't bother to bring shoes with good grip, and that'll show me, right? And so I think you can be cautious and attentive and also continue to enjoy an experience of the world. Those things are not mutually exclusive.
Camille, this has been so lovely. Can I take one last name call here?
Absolutely.
All right, good. I think we need to do a whole show on this, actually, to Anna in Duluth. Hi, Anna. What's your story?
Hi. Well, I have two daughters. They're each named after their great-grandmas. One is Julia, and my six-month-old's name is Wilhelmina Lois.
Wow, yeah.
It's a big name.
It is.
Wilhelmina is after actually five of her great-grandmas and great-great-grandmas, both on my side and my husband's side. And one of her great-great-grandmas, Wilhelmina, died in a prairie fire in North Dakota, saving her children from the fire. And I just think it's like such a statement of motherhood and the ultimate sacrifice. And so we really wanted to give her credit by naming our daughter after her. And my husband and I joked that we're going to keep a tally of how many times our little Willa cries about her name. but we hope that it empowers her because, you know, she's here because of all the Wilhelminas that came before her.
That is lovely, Anna. I'm so glad you heard the show. And thanks so much for the call.
Yeah.
Camille, this has been fun. Thanks so much. Please come back. And if you're in town, let me know, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Camille Dungy's book is called Guidebook to Relative Strangers, Journeys into Race, Motherhood, and History.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. They took all the trees and put them in a tree museum.
and charge the people a dollar, and I have to see them. No, 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 don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? You pay paradise and put up a fucking lie.
A little bit of news here coming up at the top of the hour. The FBI has searched a home of Paul Manafort's. He was Trump's former campaign manager. You'll hear more about that in the newscast.